Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. And Matt, this is a great reading. Kate, I never heard any of your poems. That was amazing. That was really, really great. I think we should all congratulate her because she just turned in her thesis, right? Or you're about to? Or so. That was really, really great. And then, scary to have to read after that. I'm going to read some poems from my first book. And then I'm going to read some new poems and also some poems from my new book, which is coming out in September. It's called The Pajamist. And the first poem I'm reading is called The Artist Must Incline His Head Just So. Often I have an idea and say it immediately. If people praise me, I wear the world shyly on top of my head. At times, I'm compelled like a fever to float without any distinctions, a sea of tin cans, love letters, and greed. The world is good for my pleasure and consumption. I admire it totally. It stands like a mountain inside and outside me. Some art may be good, some dishonest. There's no pressing need for conscription or liberty, though a car full of people rides down the highway too fast, clouded in song. My lack of compassion astounds me and must not come to know itself. It's true, I've never done anything quite like striking you across the face. There is, of course, the question of fate and whether it can be angered. Example, when not overpowered by grief, there are proper and improper ways to mourn. In such cases, my gestures are shadows, cast far from myself by one who crawls through the library, touching the books that she touched. I have dream after dream and forget each one. This is the first poem in the book. It's called Sweet Jesus. Tea, butter, the structure. We were discussing the death of iambic pentameter, though we didn't know it. She said with the notch above her lips, I have a perfect ass. And I thought the thing about asses is they're not perfect. They have a kind of fatal flaw. But I wasn't going to argue. But I wasn't going to argue with such a proud collection of stumbling convergences. I wanted to say, can I stick my eyes down your throat? But what emerged was, those eyebrows, are they for rent? How are they tragic? By announcing a mountainlessness that aches for its climbers, a brow that needs no announcing, lips that shift as mapped by insomnia, one hidden rippling bone that can never. A patio floated by. About us, a Cambridge was revolving. Somewhere, marriage was discussing a couple flattened by the new gravity of summer, but it wasn't us. We were refusing to cross that most glorious breed of slowness. I vow I will touch you, always more distant stranger. Since we have a Brooklynite here, who lives in Montreal, I'm going to read a poem called Park Slope, which is a neighborhood in Brooklyn that everybody in New York lives in Park Slope now. The whole rest of it is deserted. So, Park Slope. Where far into evening speculation is, without further instruction, a staircase one kneels, and always continuing upwards. Where I inspect myself for a black and white cat who hides my sluggishness from inspectors. His name is Joselito. Where sometimes a word can fill the sails. Where I grow smaller like a view of a harbor. Where hydrants are painted hyacinths, arguing point with pleasure in every direction, glitter slowly through conversation with windows. Where into the bitter dust of my mouth I bring my face to stare back at tacit approval, wearing huge red feverish hands, rubbing my beard like a saint. Where one logician with half an eyeglass proposes, oh perpetual attitudes of summer, light gray sky constitutes interference and is proof of a wariness high above clouds. Where his neighbor, pissing on the low wall, contends it was merely stolen from thousands of silvery windows by an amnesiac painter, a jump rope, and naked laughter. Where a silent chorus of blinking sirens asks, if so, who forgot us, stretching it onto his scaffold. Where down at the corner of afternoon and fourth, children have been invented again. Mischievous mothers, paroled from daytime, bend among the lounging bodegas, filling their starry implications of sundresses, climbing a few rungs of Spanish without me.
It's hot, this thing. I don't
some new poems. This is a poem, it's called Poem for Grace Paley. You're familiar with her, the writer, American writer Grace Paley. It's kind of great, actually. I read with her, which was sort of terrifying. It was actually terrifying. And so I read, and then she's this very small woman in her 80s and very feisty. And she came up to me afterwards, and she put her hand on my shoulder while they were introducing her, which was really nice because I think she could tell that I was, just feeling freaked out. And they were saying all this great stuff about her. She's America's finest fiction writer, blah, blah, blah. And she leaned over and whispered in my ear, said, I wish they would cut that shit out. So this is Poem for Grace Paley. People say they don't understand poetry, meaning how must we proceed? Be extremely tempered, dream a careful dream. People say we're living a quiet life, lost in a forest of pronouns, asleep for 1,000 years. People said his wife passed through him, an arrow made of smoke. People say, whatever you do, don't hitch a ride on a sepulcher. The way may be narrow, but at least it's clear. People said it was the future then, and we liked falling into mirrors. People said we were never sorry we couldn't travel both and be one traveler. People said, what was it like? It was like an airport terminal without any televisions. It was like waiting a long time for a door to arrive. In Outlaw Josie Wales, Chief Dan George says, that rock candy's not for eating, it's for looking through. In 1981, an announcer said, Ralph Sampson's so tall he could reach out and touch Uranus. I was 13. Earth was a couch. Without any irritable reaching after fact or reason, I placed thousands of sweet tarts into my mouth. 5 years later, someone said they saw Diane kissing a girl in a car. And they punched the window on the passenger side, and I laughed. And it's all been, as people say, downhill from there. Meaning, until this moment I've been coasting, but from this one forward, Grace, I vow I shall coast no more. Okay. This is the moment. This is weird. I have a poem that's called Canada that's in my new book, and it's, this actually Canada gets mentioned a lot. I don't know, just, wow. But anyway, I don't know. I probably, because I...
You love us.
Yeah, well, that's true. But no, I probably, like a lot of people would probably imagine that you all are somehow keeping the faith or something. I mean, for real, not...
For another week.
Listen, let me tell you something. I read your paper today. If that guy's got a backpedal just for suggesting that maybe judges are activists, you guys are still okay, I mean, we have a guy who, eats children for breakfast. Right? y'all are all right for the time being. So, not to be complacent, but it's okay. So anyway, this poem's called Canada, and it's... Okay. By Canada, I've always been fascinated. All that snow and acquiescing. All that emptiness. All those butterflies marshaled into an army of peace. Moving north away from me, Canada has no border. Away like the state, its northern border withers into the sky dome. In a world full of mistrust and self-medication, I've always hated Canada. It makes me feel like I'm shouting at a child for letting a handful of pine needles run through his fist. Canada gets along with everyone while I hang, a dark cloud above the schoolyard. I know we need war. All the skirmishes to keep our borders where we've placed them, all the migration, all the difference. Just like Canada, the Dalai Lama is now in Canada, and everyone is fascinated. When they come to visit me, no one ever leaves me saying, the most touching thing about him is he's so human. Or, or I was really glad to hear so many positive ideas, regardless of the consequences expressed. Or, I could drink a case of you. No one has ever pedaled every inch of thousands of roads through me to raise awareness for my struggle for autonomy. I have pity but no respect for others, which is not compassion, just ordinary love based on attitudes towards myself. I wonder how long I can endure. In Canada, the leaves are falling. When they do, each one rustles, maybe, to the white-tailed deer of sadness. And it's clear that whole country does not exist to make me feel crappy like a candelabra hanging above the prison world, condemned to freely glow. So this poem's called Minnesota. This blue vinyl couch we bought in St. Paul is winter sky color. Blue, but also a little white, with cracks like the robin's egg that fell onto what, for 8 months, in the general living space, is my balcony, where Russian mothers left their babies for me to watch. For hours, I would do nothing but dream I was writing a letter. The railing was painted that green, generally intended to make you feel you were not even intentionally being punished. I wasn't lonely. I was 22 and knew lots of things I've now forgotten, like how they made the great rivers in Siberia run backwards. There's a city called Olafsfjordur, where every winter hulls are left locked in ice so they do not rust, and what all of that had to do with me. Now on my back in Minnesota, I'm reading about phlox. The blue phlox is blue and can grow to such great heights it will no longer fit in any more poems. I'm in a land region called the Driftless Area, not because of how anyone feels. Unlike in the Young Drift Plains or the southern tip of the Canadian Shield, glaciers here did not, as they melted, deposit fertile soil, only boulders and stones. I see a little squirrel I recognize. It's so silent, I can hear his onyx nails click on the frozen snow. He watches a tree until it moves. He has one mane and an alternate nest, and lives with other squirrels in a temporary winter community called an aggregation. I hope no great watchman comes with claws to take him in the night, for he needs just one more day to master techniques of gliding from tree to tree, so he can find just what he needs, for that is what he is looking for. This poem's called Haiku. Yesterday for you, I wrote a poem so full of lies, it woke me, stunned like someone bitten in the middle of the night. You know, I don't want to read this poem, I'm sorry. I feel like reading this poem. So it's long, it's 3 pages long. It's long. This poem's called Never to Return. Never to Return. Today, a ladybug flew through my window. I was reading about the snowy plumage of the willow ptarmigan and the song of the Nashville warbler. I was reading the history of weather, how they agreed at last to disagree on cloud categories. I was reading a chronicle of the boredom that called itself the Great Loneliness and caused a war. I was reading mosquitoes rode to Hawaii on the same ship that brought the eucalyptus to California to function now as a terrible fire accelerator. Next to me, almost aloud, a book said doctors can already transplant faces. Another said, you know January can never be June, so why don't you sleep, little candle? A third thin one murmured, some days are too good. They had to have been invented in a lab. I was paging through a book of unsent postcards. Some blazed with light. Others were a little dim, as if someone had breathed on the lens. In one, it forever snowed on a city known as the Emerald in Embers. The sun had always just gone behind the mountains, never to return. and glass buildings over the harbor stayed filled with a sad green unrelated light. The postcard was called The Window Washers. In handwriting it said, "Someone left an important window open, and night the black wasp flew in and lay on the sill and died." Sometimes I stop reading and find long black hairs on my keyboard, and would like you to know that in 1992, I mixed Clairol dye number 2 with my damaged bleached hair to create a blue-green never seen before. My best look, according to the girl at the counter who smiled only once. I know less than I did before, and I live on a hill where the wind steals music from everything and brings it to me. This is the last poem I'm going to read, and it's called Andale Mano, which is the name of a font, computer font. And thanks so much for listening and being here, and I'm looking forward to the second half of the reading. Exciting. Andale Mano. Today, I walked past my door in the rain and put an old key in a lock from which gold light shone. Gold light through the keyhole, like didactic material below a painting, glows to explain the 19th century and other things we must know. In the poem, we want to try to set off a light each time the door of the closet is closed, and to be for the reader a mechanism attached to a string the poem pulls, and piecing together as desperately as we can. By fragments, we mean pieces of things we thought we have heard, and when we say them, mean, though we cannot see you, we love you. By light, we mean light. Fear is a mechanism, thinking too much and not enough about the closet holding something. The light in the closet is on. The garments are thinking. The door to the closet opens into a long, empty corridor we fear. For verily, it, like a torch in the British sense, through a dusty room pervades us. When we're walking with our torch, meaning flashlight, before us, reaching for the long poem inside us, one door explains how to read for both meaning and pleasure. Another shuts. The poem Andale Mano begins. When I was a child, I used to give speeches into the mouth of the dishwasher, open and gleaming. When, in a private language, I said, "Ritual laughter, mother and father, without knowing, commit, transmits a kind of anger," it understood, though they were not. Today, I walked right past the face of a woman I was sure was an Andale Mano. Today, I walked right past the poem I knew and looked as I entered the room. She's a Finger Lake. In one hand, she's holding a sweater, pink. In the other, a cream-colored spatula. Which one do you like best? The poem is now my wife. For the first time today in Andale Mano, I drew my shoulders back and looked straight forward and slightly up. All day, for the first time, things were true size. Droplets hung from my lashes, strobing at times the warehouse next to the elevated, at others the brand new cathedral, from which small people were streaming, lugging large black musical instrument cases. Large black chambers hold the delicate wooden chambers for making chamber music. In Andale Mano, things are both breakable and strong. In Andale Mano, just out of reach of my dangling hand, the lock was a tiny door. Thank you very much.
So I want to thank Matt, Matthew, and Kate for reading. The nice thing about Matthew is that he's so human. I can ride a bicycle for you. So take about 15 minutes to peruse the books.